Matilda Mania, Trump's Troubles, Housing Deal and Wage Reset, plus Wind in Wollongong. This is The Week on Wednesday. Hello and welcome to The Week on Wednesday. I am your co-host, Ben Davison, and joining me, as always, is the great, the glorious, the best-selling author of QAnon and On, A Short and Shocking History of Internet Conspiracy Cults, and The Guardian's Guide to Getting on Board with the Matildas, my wife and your friend, Van Badham. How are you, Van?
Well, Craig Foster, praise be upon his name, St. Craig Foster, shared my piece about the Matildas today, which is about how to be a fan. If you're a latecomer to the sport, as I have said, doesn't matter how you get to church, as long as you find salvation. And we are a round ball house. I was reminded very happily this morning of that it's 8 years to the day that the club that Ben founded, Klub, which is in the Melbourne Chinese Soccer Association, there was a beautiful photo of Ben absolutely just going it, I've got to say, in his beautiful Ben-flavoured kit with his little Che Guevara hat and his sunglasses goggles, and his soccer was too cute for words. And you won your tournament 8 years ago today, which I think is a good sign. Oh, Craig Foster, Australian international, head of the Australian Republican Movement, refugee advocate, the kind of man that more men really should try to be more like. He is obviously, you know, internationally regarded, former professional player, and shared my piece about leaning into fandom.
Delightful.
And I've got to say, the emotion has run high in this house over the course of the Women's World Cup. Ben, is this or is this not true?
That's absolutely true. Look, it's an amazing situation. The Matildas are such a great example of the Australian spirit in so many ways, Van. Of course, one of those ways is that they are all union members. And, of course, Katrina Gorry, who
is your favourite player.
My favourite Matilda. My favourite Matilda. There's a great meme, and I've shared it on social media, about how Katrina Gorry and the other Matildas stood firm to get a collective agreement to improve the pay and conditions of the Matildas. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago that this was a team that had to fundraise just to attend tournaments. It had to pay for its own accommodation. Now, this is a fully professional team with players who play at clubs as big as Manchester City, Real Madrid,
Arsenal,
Lyon in France. These are incredible, incredible players. And, of course, all union members. You know, and if you're listening to this podcast and you're not a union member,
oh my,
you know, it's hard to believe that you've stumbled across us. You're not a union member. Join, go to australianunions.org.au/wow, that's W-O-W. Join your union, be like the Matildas, and basically every major sporting code, by the way, is fully unionised. But, Van, the Matildas are really, they are making history. They're just kicking goals literally and figuratively all over the place.
Oh, they're pretty amazing. And it's worth remembering just how dire things were for the Matildas as late as 2015. So in 2015 was when they actually went on strike for 2 months because they were being paid, and I am not joking, $22,000 a year.
That's ridiculous.
That is completely ridiculous. And, of course, the history of the Matildas is of them, like you said, fundraising, doing bake sales to pay for hotel rooms, like completely insane. They had to make their own kit, and only when they got their collective agreement were they provided with the support for someone else to do their laundry. And, of course, they fought an equal pay demand, going, well, why are the men in this sport, who, by the way, have not reached the international heights that we have, being paid more? And, of course, the argument around women's sport, and I went off on a tear about the Matildas last week and my love for them and just the impact I think they're having on the community and thinking about women's sport. But the argument around women's sport was like, oh, who would watch it and who would pay for it and what are the economics of it? And, Ben, the economics of it, rather significant, actually. Did you know that the entire town of Port Macquarie, you cannot obtain Matildas merchandise there? Did you know?
I did know that because I've read the brief that you you so lovingly prepared for the show. But you're absolutely right about the economic impact, because we're talking about more people watching the Matildas than just about anything else on television over the last two decades. We're talking, as you say, you can't get scarves. Jersey sales have increased 450%, beanies 225%.
Scarves? 2,650% the sales. Yes.
These are huge, huge numbers. Brand Finance, which is one of those marketing outfits that calculates the value of a brand, that's an intangible asset on the balance sheet for those accountants playing along at home.
Everything about you just attracts me, yes.
Has said that the Matilda's brand has gone from about $40 million before the World Cup to $210 million now that they're in the semi-finals. And, of course, if you're listening to this, you may already know the results. We may well be in the final by the time you've listened to this. Either way, let us just say that it has been a phenomenal effort. This is a team of players who have come together at one stage in the group in the group stages of the of this tournament. There was talk that the coach would be sacked after the not great performance against Ireland, the loss to Nigeria. Now, of course, Richard Marles, the Minister for Defence, has shot a video of himself satirically resigning as Minister for Defence and making Mackenzie Arnold, the Matilda's goalkeeper.
The brick wall.
The Minister for Defence of Australia. You know, these are phenomenal shifts in the cultural conversation, the economics of the conversation. And at the same time, Van, you know, we are having a bit of a conversation, perhaps prematurely. I think Dan Andrews' point is the conversation about public holiday is a bit premature. But Peter Malinauskas has heard the call.
He's the Premier of South Australia, everybody.
And he's heard the call of Melissa Barbieri, who is a former Matilda, goalkeeping legend for the Matildas, Melissa Barbieri, who has said that rather than have a public holiday, we should be funding women's sport, in particular football. And he's ponied up $18 million, $10 million of which is for women's football.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And this is the argument. It's the – so there's been debate about if the Matildas make it to the final and they win. And, you know, there are some steps. There are some bars to clear before that happens. It's a hypothetical conversation. Do we get a national public holiday? Well, I mean, personally, I suggest that we may need one.
Yeah.
I mean, I certainly will be in – and you know this quite well, given my reaction to the victory over France – that I will be in no physical state to do a full day of work if the Matildas win. Mm. And this is a person who has not had any alcohol in 15 years. Sometimes the adrenaline is enough. But certainly the discussion around, well, what is of value to this game that everybody has fallen in love with? A game that, I mean, you and I obviously are very devoted.
Mm.
I want everybody to know that we made a pilgrimage to Old Trafford, which is, of course, the home ground of Manchester United, yep, which is Ben's EPL team. And Ben literally sat in Sir Alec Ferguson's chair. He's the famous Manchester United coach, and cried. And I've never seen such happy crying. Like, it was a moment of realization, joy. And I finally understood many things about world religions and the power of faith and belief and participation in community, watching Ben's face, which I did photograph and may share later. But it's a really important conversation about why was the women's game allowed to lag? Like, doesn't it seem like total nonsense now that all of this investment went into the men's game when the women are literally outselling them on kit 13 to 1? That's one of the figures that I've seen bandied about. And this enormous influx of interest in the game as well. Another figure that's been around this week, and Malinauskas mentioned similar figures in South Australia. In Victoria, there has been a 3,000% increase in fielding. I think it's 300. Sorry, everybody added the zero. Not the treasurer, so it's okay. A 300% increase. I know where I got those figures wrong, because it's usually 3,000 inquiries a year about kids joining football clubs, and it's now up to 9,000.
Wow.
So there you go.
There you go.
And like, this huge interest in people joining clubs. And of course, Craig Foster himself said, if you've discovered a love of the game, join your local club. Your local A-League club has a women's division. Mm. It's both, like, boys and girls football. You will be able to support both, you know, be part of the community, get involved, like, embrace it. And it's happening. Like, those numbers on scarves alone are just crazy. And the fact that entire towns are selling out of Matilda's merch, kids want to play the game, girls are excited, boys are excited, and the children don't see a difference between the male and female game, which they shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, kids don't care. Kids don't become misogynists or internalize the values of patriarchy. There's something we do to children. And amazing, if we stop doing it, guess what? The kids are all right. Like, they can actually see themselves and what's going on. But Malinowskis also said there's been a 33% increase, or they're predicting a 33% increase in participation in women's football just in South Australia alone, as people connect to the game and go, yeah, you know, there's a future in this. And if you're a young athlete, and I think I might have mentioned this on the show last week, but I might have learned it since. Sam Kerr is from an AFL family. Mm. Like, her brother Pat played for the West Coast Eagles infamously, lost the Brownlow medal to Ben Cousins by 1 point. How would you feel? You'd never get over it, frankly. Anyway, and Sam Kerr wanted to play AFL. And at the time that she was, like, a young sporting person, those opportunities weren't available to women. There was no AFLW. Mm. And somebody said, oh, you know, there's a women's team, like a women's team that plays soccer, maybe you should try that, and the rest is history. Well, if you're a talented athlete, if you're a team player, if you love anything round the bounces, like, why wouldn't you go towards football now? Because there are career pathways in it. You know, the professionalisation of the sport, which has been achieved through their industrial action, their own action as union members, is what's creating those pathways.
Oh, absolutely. And Craig Foster is absolutely right. Supporting the domestic game is so important. And, of course, we know that there are overseas opportunities as well. You know, there are vast numbers of Australian, particularly women players, playing at incredibly high levels overseas. Sam Kerr, of course, at Chelsea. Hayley Rasso at Real Madrid. These are, you know, I sometimes still think people don't quite grasp the meaning of the words Real Madrid in this country. I mean, around the world, that is we talk about brand sometimes. That is a brand name that is recognized globally. To don the all white strip of Real Madrid, any Real Madrid team, is an incredible honor. And Hayley Rasso will be doing that this season, on the back of being at least a World Cup semi-finalist. Amazing career. What a career. What a thing to be able to tell people.
You know, and I also feel like, because, you know, I lived overseas for 10 years and you lived overseas. Ben lived in Norway. I lived in England, and both of us are very, very well travelled. But, I mean, we love football, and it is the world game, and it's the language that the rest of the world speaks. And I feel like finally the rest of Australia, beyond what has been the football community, is getting what it means to be part of that globalization, the global nature of the game. And in my article, I mentioned it. This is a game that's played by the poorest of the poor, the shoeless kids in the favelas in Brazil play football. And the son of the Sultan of Brunei is a professional football player.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
Gaddafi's son played for Perugia in the 90s.
Like, yeah, like, I mean, everybody played for Perugia, you know, in the 90s, Ben, but Tom Tish!
But at the same time, you know, Carlos Tevez, who played for Argentina and ended up finishing his career in very lucrative contracts in China, recently was talking about the reason why he took the lucrative career in China, having played for Manchester United, the club, as you mentioned, so close to my heart, having been an Argentine international, was because the money was so good that he could support not just his own immediate family, but his brothers and his uncles and basically 15 families, and so that they could have educations and get out of the poverty that he had grown up in Argentina, so that a Tevez would never again have to make it big in football just to have an ordinary, decent life. I mean, this is the power of football, is that it is transformative. It's transformative of individuals, of families, of communities. And we're seeing that happen now in Australia, the transformation that it's bringing right across the country, the conversations that are happening between parents and their children, between neighbours around women's sport and the role that women's sport has in our community. And it's phenomenal to see, you know, you sometimes see, or a part of a transformative social change that you have no control over, but is just so positive and so inspiring. And we need to keep it going beyond the semi-final, whatever the outcome is, whether we win the World Cup, whether we finish fourth, it's the best result of an Australian football team ever. So far, we hope, of course, to go beyond this, hopefully this tournament, if not this tournament, the next tournament. But we have to keep the positivity going, keep the nation moving in this positive direction, because otherwise, you know, man, we don't have to look very far to see when there is an internal negativity.
Are you segueing into a discussion about our American cousins?
I am going to segue into a discussion about our American cousins, because while we have some negative, what would they be? Negative Nathans here in Australia who are, you know, poo-pooing the Matildas, or, you know, don't like the idea of a public holiday or investment.
Are you talking about the person who...
The man who has very little pride, who happens to run the Nationals, and the one who looks like a potato who's in charge of the whole coalition. You know, I think they're...
Who even are those guys?
They're negative Nathans when it comes to these things. But, you know, they do mimic the negativity and the toxicity of some of our less reputable cousins in the US fan. And recently, probably the least reputable of all of them has now been indicted once again. And of course, I'm talking about here, the hairpiece himself, Donald Trump.
Oh my.
You know, and
Fourth indictment. This is amazing. Like, this has literally never happened before, let alone four times. The only president in United States history to be impeached twice.
Yeah.
It has demonstrably and in public been on a crime spree. And I think if you approach it from that framework, going, this is actually a career criminal who's been insulated from consequences his entire life because of the money he had or the power he wielded. And now that he's no longer president of the United States, now he is the former guy, and Trump does not have the power to shut down, for example.
He doesn't have presidential immunity.
He doesn't have pardon power, and he doesn't have the ability to shut down the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
He is now being subjected to the consequences of his actions in office. The latest one, and I will go through the other indictments because there is a context, but it is really important that Australians are across this, because the United States are our most powerful ally.
Mm.
We made a choice at the height of World War II that we were going to throw a lot in with the United States for defensive reasons, in terms of our trading relationships, the framework by which we negotiate our alliances with the rest of the world all hinges on the United States. Anybody who forgets this needs to be reminded about the Vietnam War, which we went to because the Americans were going. That is how deep, and not a good war, not a sensible war, a war with enormously negative consequences for everybody who went, but we went because of the United States. So where they go, so go we. And if their president is a career criminal with contempt for democracy, doing blatantly illegal things and lying about them, that's something that we should be concerned about, because he is running for election again, Ben. This is the thing.
Yeah.
He is.
And he could be convicted and still win and become president.
He could be in prison and still be president. He could still win the presidency of the United States, even if he's in prison. And the chances of that have improved over the past week, because what has now happened is that his committed in public attempts to overthrow the results of the 2020 presidential election have now brought him into the crosshairs of Fannie Willis, who is the top prosecutor for Fulton County in Georgia. So, I mean, the American legal system is...
And Fulton County is the county where the state capital of Atlanta is.
Atlanta, yes. Yeah. And it is a heavily Democratic area.
Yeah.
Fannie Willis is a Democrat.
Yeah.
And Fannie Willis was elected to the job because they elect prosecutors in America. Okay, guys. Sure, that sounds great. And she began an investigation into Trump almost immediately based on a phone call that was made public where Trump literally phoned up and heavied the Georgia Secretary of State, who's in charge of the electoral process. So you elect the person in charge of the electoral process. Doesn't also sound really, really great. No, it's not. Your very old system. Yeah. Like, I'm sure these seem like really great ideas in the 1770s. Maybe. But, no. Anyway, Brad Raffensperger is a Republican, and he had voted for Trump.
Yeah.
And Trump phoned him when the votes turned against Trump in Georgia, which is traditionally a Republican state.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously the Deep South, Georgia. Yeah. And
part of the old Confederacy.
The last Republican to lose Georgia was George W. Bush in 1992, presumably because H.W. Bush, the George Bush Senior, presumably because Bill Clinton was from Arkansas and more southern,
also south of the Mason-Dixie line.
Right? Also Mason-Dixie, yes, and you know Southerners got a Southerner. But Brad Raffensperger, the Attorney General, recorded the phone conversation with Trump, who was still technically the president of the United States at the time because the transition hadn't happened, who asked him to just find him 11,000. It's like, find me 11,560 votes, I believe. I need one more than what they're saying Biden's got, and then we win, and then we can all go home. And this phone conversation, amazingly, ended up becoming very, very public. And Fannie Willis heard it and went, yeah, no, that's actual criminal conspiracy to defraud the electors of the state of Georgia. There were three recounts in Georgia when Biden beat Trump. Three. And there's lots of demographic information about this. You know, there are a lot of Hollywood studios in Georgia now, very favorable tax breaks for entertainment industry. It's very, very pretty. It's got like, it has been, parts of Georgia have been becoming more liberal, more progressive, more democratic. So it's not impossible to believe that Biden would win there.
No, and they were very close. So these are election results that are very, very close. You know, you're talking about 12, 15,000 votes, the presidential election and the two Senate races, again, very, very close.
Yeah, but and it was 11,560 votes, which is why Trump fined Brad Raffensperger and said, can you find those votes for me? So, I mean, that's very illegal. That's very, very illegal because the votes were in, they had been counted, they had been certified. There was no, this was not just a mate finding a mate going, mate, can you help me out?
So this has resulted in Trump being charged under racketeering laws, right? Under the RICO.
Because it's not just the phone call, and that's the thing. So in America, obviously, I'm sure you've seen The Godfather, years and years of organized crime. And one of the problems that that authorities have had in the United States over, you know, the hundreds of years is how do you actually prosecute organized crime? Like famously Al Capone, the most famous gangster ever from the Prohibition era, they got him on tax evasion because they couldn't pin murders on him directly. Like they couldn't, he was running a criminal enterprise, which is known as a racket. And so various jurisdictions in the United States have anti-racketeering laws. So you don't have to do the murders yourself to go to prison for them if you're ordering the other people to do the murders or do the theft or do the vice or break the law in any way. And of course, Fannie Willis's case, which is quite comprehensive because it also has 18 other people co-indicted in it. So there are 19 people, including Trump, up on these charges. She is prosecuting all of them as an organized criminal conspiracy working in cahoots to defraud the voters of the state of Georgia by interfering in the election, by participating in all kinds of intimidatory exercises, which are illegal, the attempt to get Brad Raffensperger to just change the result. But it's getting even crazier. And a lot of this stuff has been on the public record for a while, but Willis has pulled it all together in this 19-person indictment, saying it's not just illegal for the phone calls to be made, they also gained illegal access to the voting machine. So in America, they, for some reason, They don't do it with a pencil and paper, which we Australians find quite reliable and easy to audit. They use voting machines that, of course, have all of this IP-protected software and data that's collected, and an electoral worker who was associated with the Republican Party let them in, let other Trumpists in to download all the data from the voting machines and breach significant number of laws around privacy, data protection, IP, and the concern is even though they didn't have the access to be able to change any votes, that giving that kind of data, which is highly protected, to whoever, means that potentially Republicans or the Russians could work out with that data how they could hack the systems and change the votes at some other point. It is just amazing. There were electoral workers, Shamos and her mother, Ruby Freeman, who were these two black Atlantans who were participating in the vote, they're counting votes, like electoral workers everywhere, who were identified in conspiracy theory videos as stealing votes, which is not what happened.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely, there was no wrongdoing. It was all part of their standard counting process. They were fetching boxes of votes that were under a table, but had been identified by conspiracy theorists as, you know, rigging the election by the Trumpists. Mm-hmm. And these two women were subjected to personal intimidation. A police chaplain from Chicago drove to Atlanta to turn up at their house and basically tell them unless they unrigged the election, they were going to go to hell. Like, Kanye West's publicist, this is one of the weirdest things. One of the indicted is Kanye West's publicist who managed to drag Shamos and Ruby Freeman into a police precinct and tell them that they had to make statements that the election had been stolen or, you know, they would be held to pay. Like, these amazing acts of intimidation against these innocent poll workers who ended up, like, having to go into hiding. They famously gave evidence of the January 6th commission to investigate what the hell happened on January 6th. And they talked about the power of the Trumpist mob and the moment that they had been named. And Trump himself was putting out tweets and all of this material saying, oh, the election was stolen in Georgia. These videos of people stealing votes, blah, blah, blah. And it was these innocent women who were targeted and their lives were just completely destroyed. And that was the evidence that they gave. But the idea that these random people were turning up and engaging in acts of intimidation is just absolutely mad. They went to their homes.
Well, I mean, this is part of the case, isn't it, that these are not actually random people. These are people who are
operatives.
They're part of a criminal conspiracy.
Yes, known as, you know, significant elements of the Republican Party, and certainly this is how this was organized. I mean, there was this incredible scheme, like the January 6th event, the riot channeled to the Capitol, was sort of framed around this idea. A lawyer called John Eastman, who's just like crazy right-wing academic, managed to get into Trump's ear with this theory that if Mike Pence, the vice president, refused to certify the votes from the states, because they collect the votes, so it's a ridiculous system. Okay, guys, please, you're allowed to redraft the decisions you made in the 1700s. You are allowed to do a bit of an assessment, maybe see what's working for you. But the vice president oversees the sort of, like, you know, receives the votes.
Yeah.
So what the conspiracy seems to have been was putting out this notion that, oh, it was corrupt and people like Ruby Freeman were stealing votes or corrupting the voting machines or whatever. So there were electoral irregularities in states that went against Trump, and therefore Mike Pence would use his vice presidential power to go, oh, there were electoral irregularities. We won't accept the electors, the people who, you know, vouch for the votes from the state, college, which is part of their electoral college process. We won't accept the actual electors. We'll say that because it was dodgy, we will instead name a bunch of other electors who will represent the citizens of the state and give the election to Trump. And Eastman convinced Trump and Trump's lawyers like Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani that this would work because, you know, it was based on an interpretation of electoral law within the Constitution that they thought they could get away with. The problem was that Mike Pence, for all of his faults, and my, that man has many. Number one, let's just get it out there. He is a desperately homophobic individual. Mike Pence was like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. That doesn't seem very legal. I don't think that's a good idea. And rang Dan Quayle, which is certainly a blast from the past. He was vice president to George H.W. Bush, the man who famously couldn't spell potato.
Yeah.
He said, and Mike Pence phones him, and Dan Quayle is like, yeah, no, you can't do that, man. Like, that's not a thing. And so Mike Pence wouldn't do it. And that's why Trump was using the mob on January 6th with the, you know, Mike, all you have to do is the right thing, and putting that kind of pressure. And you had the crowd like shaking gallows going, hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. That was why, because of this cockamamie theory. I mean, it is absolute madness, but they thought they could get away with it. And what's really stunning is the number of people and the stature of the people, Republican Party officials, you know, like Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff, who knew better, who is not like these are not stupid people.
Yeah,
these are people who just thought they had an opportunity.
They're not former apprentice contestants.
Right? No,
these are lifetime career.
The former apprentice contestant that he employed walked out on the White House.
That's right, she did.
She was like, "Yeah, no, screw this, I'm going." Like, it is just, it is absolutely amazing, and of course, all of this stuff is on the public record because they were whipping up their base and pumping out everything they were doing. And you had journalists at the New York Times, the Washington Post, at CNN, who were like, hang on, like, what is this? Who were onto it at all points. But it is genuinely terrifying what's going on. It is really interesting that, because the thing that's interesting about this is the way that anti-racketeering law works in Georgia is that it actually puts – Trump is more vulnerable in Georgia than he is anywhere else because of the size and breadth of that law and the meticulousness with which the charges have been put together. And the other thing too is that Trump is running out of money, because all of these lawsuits, and I'll talk about some of the other ones, are very, very, very expensive. You need a lot of lawyers who are prepared to never work again, given their association with Trump, to sort of defend you in these expansive and enormous cases. And there are 4 indictments that Trump is facing at the moment in different jurisdictions. But not everybody has the money that Trump has. And Trump, various Trump fundraising vehicles have been asking for money to be reassigned from electoral campaigning ahead of the next election to funding his legal defense.
Yeah.
Not all of the 19 people who have been charged have those kind of resources, maybe even not Kanye West's publicist.
Yeah.
So obviously there's a fairly concrete structural incentive there for the co-indicted to cut deals and maybe share what they know because who is going to protect them? I mean, Donald Trump notoriously abandons the people who stick up for him and fires them and denies the money and the rest of it. So he's more vulnerable than he has been in the past.
Because most of the other cases are really just him, aren't they? They're allegations about him and what he did do or what he didn't do, what he knew, what he instructed someone to do. Whereas this is
a criminal conspiracy.
Yeah, criminal conspiracy.
It's a racket.
Yeah. And so, you know, you could have situations where some of the co-indicted could actually have settlements where they would testify to what they know, and that may incriminate Trump to beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing. So the Trump defense at this point is, it's free speech. Me calling up Brad Raffensperger and saying, find me 11,000 votes, is just me exercising my constitutional right to free speech. And me, like, sicking mobs onto people like Ruby Freeman and Shay Moss, like, yeah, I mean, that's just free speech, and I can't be held responsible for how other people interpret that. This has been this was his whole thing around January 6th, that he didn't do anything wrong. He just said some stuff. And what does that really mean?
It's like a weird inversion of just following orders, isn't it? It's like you're the commander-in-chief of the most powerful military in the world. You ring up the attorney general, who's a member of your party that you're the leader of a state, and say, find me these votes in order for me to win the election. And that's apparently just free speech. There's no intimidation. What's intimidating about that? I'm just calling from the Oval Office as President of the United States, commander of the largest, most powerful military in the world, and telling the Attorney General of one of the 50 states which I'm president of to find me some votes. I can see how his argument doesn't stack up.
Well, what Willis has done really well is, I mean, the only witnesses that she's called, because, I mean, the justice system is very strange in America. Yeah. To even get Trump indicted, they convene what's called a grand jury, which is a secret jury of locals where the trial, a trial may take place. And the majority of that secret jury hears evidence from the prosecutors saying, can we proceed with this case? And if a majority says yes, then the case proceeds. And it, obviously, witnesses are called, like this is all this process. And she only called Republicans. She didn't call any Democrats at all, only Republicans. And she's clearly like getting all of her ducks in a row because it's very hard to say, oh, this is all politically motivated when literally everybody providing evidence is theoretically on your team.
Yeah.
But it'll be really interesting. Rudy Giuliani is one of the co-indicted as well. Sidney Powell, who's the infamous Kraken lawyer, the one who said the election had been stolen by the ghost of Hugo Chavez using satellites in Italy. I mean, it is pretty crazy what's going on. But this is, of course, his fourth indictment. I just want to keep you up to date on his others. He was indicted in April for allegedly falsifying business records to keep an alleged affair quiet during the 2016 election. This is, of course, the Stormy Daniels case. Stormy Daniels is an adult entertainer. And Stormy Daniels had a story that she had slept with Donald Trump while he was married to Melania. And she was definitely paid $130,000 on Trump's instruction through his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, who has since grown a conscience and spilt the beans on everything he knows, which has been fantastic to watch. Frankly, I always believe I love a good redemption story. Michael Cohen, you're all right by me now. But Alvin Bragg, who's the district attorney in the state of New York, where this is taking place, has said that the $130,000 that Trump gave her, he wrote it off as a legal expense. And Alvin Bragg is saying, oh, no, 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 that's an electoral expense. And that's an offense under the around electoral disclosure laws. You can't just pay off adult entertainers so they won't cause you problems in the election campaign and say it's
and then claim it as a business induction.
Donald Trump, I should point out, has repeatedly denied, despite the quite in-depth revelations made by Stormy Daniels, that he had anything to do with her. It's also interesting that if the story was untrue, you'd give her $130,000. And a judge denied his request to move that case to a federal court. So that's still ongoing.
Yeah.
He's also in trouble in Florida, which is, of course, where he lives at Mar-a-Lago, the tasteless little tacky club that he runs for right-wing golf enthusiasts. In Florida, he was indicted in June for hiding classified information and lying about it. You've all seen the photos. The FBI had to raid the property to get back, oh, American nuclear secrets, which were in boxes in a bathroom that basically anybody had access to, which given the fact that there are people who have, you know, taken a piece of paper home from the Department of Defense in the United States and lost their jobs, lost their careers. Like the idea that you would take boxes and boxes and boxes is never really justified. Why? He was showing them to people who are recordings of him going, I shouldn't be showing you this, but ha ha ha. And obviously was subject to a raid. He used his staff at Mar-a-Lago to lie to the FBI to like, it's just absolutely amazing.
I've seen him at rallies say that he's entitled to take all of these things, none of which is based on any legal precedent or fact or reality.
No.
He's just literally telling people what he wants them to believe.
Yeah, that he's allowed to have nuclear secrets. Like, it is amazing.
In the bathroom.
I'm just like, have you never watched television? Like, any American show, like, people get punished with more serious punishments for infringing the Secrets Act on Star Trek, you know, in a future that doesn't even exist. And the idea that Trump thinks, oh, well, you know, this is no problem. I mean, and it's pretty serious. Like, they, like, even discussing the evidence has like 1,000 layers of security around it because this is about America's nuclear arsenal at a time when one of America's allies is at war with America's adversary, Russia. The idea that you would just have nuclear secrets in a bathroom is kind of amazing. And the fact that Trump himself ordered staff members at Mar-a-Lago to delete security camera footage of the documents being stored, like all of it is bad. In D.C., so there's another trial upcoming for that. In D.C., he's awaiting a trial date after being charged with plotting to overturn the 2020 election and the events that led up to the January 6th attack on the Capitol. This is, of course, he's pleaded not guilty to this. He always pleads not guilty, by the way. He's pleaded not guilty to everything. But these are federal charges. There's a special counsel, Jack Smith, who is a man of some renown, having been one of the prosecuting lawyers at The Hague prosecuting people for war crimes. He's used to difficult defendants. I think is the polite way of saying it. And there may be unindicted, as yet unindicted co-conspirators who may be facing indictment in that particular case. But a grand jury said, yeah, there's grounds to proceed on this. So that's in federal court, and that's about the crazy fake elector scheme and John Eastman. Mm. Yeah, man, we can just get Mike Pence to just throw it. So that's also ongoing. And then, of course, back in New York, he is going back to trial after having lost a trial in April this year. So an American writer called E. Jean Carroll alleged that Donald Trump had raped her back in the 1990s, and that it had, you know, destroyed her on a fundamental level, as rape often does to women. These were her allegations. Mm. Well, we don't have to say they were allegations anymore, because Trump came out and went, oh, she's not even my type, gave extremely weird evidence where he actually, like, attacked one of the lawyers going, you're not my type either, which is kind of an extraordinary thing to say if you're facing rape charges. Well, they weren't rape charges, they were defamation charges. So E. Jean Carroll, the statute of limitations, I think, had run out for her to prosecute a rape case. But when he said, she's not even my type, oh, my God, as if I would, and made out that she was some random crazy person, she sued him for defamation, knowing full well that the rape allegations would be heard in the context of that trial, and they were her case, saying he did rape me, it did happen, and him trying to discredit me is defamatory.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Trump lost that case. He was ordered to pay her $5 million and damages, in damages and obviously costs and the rest of it. And the judge said, yes, this man is a rapist, which is, you know, really a hell of a thing to have a court say. And Trump, despite having just agreed to that, well, being obliged into that settlement, not agreed, it wasn't settled, it did go to court, he came out and published statements saying she was a whack job and he was innocent. This was after the jury had reached its verdict. So E. Jean Carroll, not to be dissuaded, has brought him back to court to sue him again, because he has defamed her again. And given the fact that the precedent is that a judge said, dude's a rapist and he owes you $5 million, it's extraordinary. But what's really extraordinary, there was a brilliant essay by an American writer called Heather Cox Richardson, who's great, from my Atlantic newsletter, which I get so much value out of, as well, you know, where she was talking about the framework of what's going on and the fact that Trump has been able to act with impunity, because even just say he never did break the law. The things he has said and done are absolutely unconscionable. And he has lied. We know that he has lied. This is demonstrable. What political theorists call what's going on is called political technology. And political technology is about when you create a media environment where people in it only believe what you tell them.
Mm.
And what's happened in the United States is that the Republican Party base, the people who participate in the Republican Party, who vote in Republican primaries, select the candidates, do the fundraising, they have absolutely taken the view of the world, according to Donald Trump, Steve Bannon, Stephen Miller, Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, and the whole coterie of gross misfits around him, as truth. And these people do not believe that the evidence, the sworn testimony that appears in courts is true, even though Rudy Giuliani has admitted that he lied publicly about Seamus and Ruby Freeman, and he was part of the disinformation that discredited them and led to their lives being ruined. He has admitted that in court, but not on TV. And the Trump base believes what they see on conservative television. And it's a really interesting point that you have this really large population of politically active people in the United States who believe that Joe Biden is the real criminal, even though there's no evidence to support that, and Donald Trump is innocent, just the victim of a witch hunt, despite the copious amounts of his own statements and his own photographs and sworn testimony and all of these legal proceedings that have established the evidence around him, that they call that BS. It's just BS. There was an interview with a Republican voter on CNN yesterday. But they're reaching a point where that manufactured
reality and the truth are about to collide, and what it might mean in the United States is anyone's guess, whether these people will go, oh, hang on, we got led down a dark path. But it's a really dark time. I mean, the other thing about what's happening in Georgia, if Trump is found guilty, he will go to jail. Mm. And even if he does get elected president from prison, he doesn't have state pardon power in the state of Georgia. In fact, pardon power doesn't exist in Georgia. So getting him out of prison is that it's not.
It could be the first. He could be the first president. It seems like he'll be the first presidential candidate facing prison. He could very well be the first presidential candidate in prison. And if things go badly for democracy, he could be the first president sworn in prison.
That would be pretty bad. I mean, I do encourage everybody to listen to the interview I did with Miles Taylor, who is the Trump administration whistleblower, if you haven't heard it before, because, I mean, he was there. He was in the room where this stuff was taking place and just went, it doesn't matter how much of a Republican I've been, this is absolutely unhinged. And this is the end stage of democracy unless people stand up and do something about it. And, you know, I mean, I love America and I love the idea of America, even though I have huge structural criticisms of their justice system, because in America, the idea is that anyone could be president.
Mm.
And the converse of that is that any president should be liable to go to jail if they break the law. The law must be applied equally. I think it's actually a huge opportunity. If he is found guilty in a court of his peers with no interference, guilty of these crimes, he should go to jail. That's absolutely what should happen. He has the right to a fair trial like everybody else. Yeah. I don't think necessarily threatening the judges and threatening and giving everybody names. He calls Fannie Willis phony Fanny. He was going off his brain about it today. I don't necessarily think that means he brings to that process the kind of jurisprudence and fairness and commitment to legal ethics that one would really hope anybody had, let alone a former president. But hell, does seem he's been on a crime spree.
It does. And then your point about people only consuming the information that they want in order to reinforce their worldview, in order to then dismiss fact and reality, in order to perpetuate their own concepts about what is real and what isn't.
Are you talking about the Emperor Mandarins at the Reserve Bank again?
Well, it's a very interesting segue in my mind into what's happened today and in the last few days here in Australia with our economy, because of course today, Wednesday, the National Cabinet met and the first ministers from every state and territory met with the Prime Minister to talk about housing and the issues around housing. And now we've heard a lot from the Greens about what they want to do for renters, and I'd encourage everyone to check out the Friendly Geordies video. Well, he does give this podcast a shout out, so fair play. You should watch the Geordie video.
It's called Pyramid Scheme, and he absolutely dismembers the Greens. I've never seen anything so comprehensive, and they don't come out of it well, Ben.
No, because they have absolutely been sealed in their own information bubble. And what National Cabinet has done today is a fundamental reset on housing in this country. So the National Cabinet has agreed to increase the targeted number of new homes from 1 million to 1.2 million over a five-year period. So that's a 20% increase in the number of new social and affordable homes in what are called well-located. So these are new well-located homes. Now, in order to increase density, there's a whole range of incentives here. There's a $3 billion performance-based funding called the New Home Bonus for states and territories that achieve more than their share of the 1.2 million well-located home target. That's in order to increase supply. We've talked on the show before about the need to increase supply. This, again, is about how do we have practical interventions into the economy that the government can afford, that the labour market, the workers are available to do, that supply chains can handle. These are all quite targeted. And there will be a $500 million competitive funding program for local and state governments to help them do things like connect essential services, amenities, and go through the building planning process. These are all important things. And Geordie makes the point on the pyramid scheme video that you can't just start building a house tomorrow, right? You've got to go through planning processes and you've got to go through all sorts of
heritage assessments.
And this is
water assessments.
Yeah. And this is one of the other key things that has come out of today's meeting is a national planning reform blueprint. So this is planning, zoning, land release, and other measures to improve housing supply. Now, I've always said that there are lots of things we need to do around the tax system and around housing as an investment, but also we do need to do things around planning because we've seen terrible planning decisions made in this country. We've seen...
This might be in the context of Ben and I currently having no driveway because planning decisions where we live meant that they just didn't do them properly. Because they didn't think the town was going to get any bigger.
So there's lots of things in inner cities as well.
Oh, we know. Oh.
Where you know, there's not the medium and high density housing that there needs to be. So that's a huge step in the right direction to connect people. We can't just have cities that continually eat
sprawl
up farmland. You know, Melbourne cannot be one long highway from the Bay to Ballarat. It can't be from the Bay to Bendigo. You know, Sydney cannot be just one long string along the coastline of New South Wales.
From Wollongong to Newcastle. No, it can't. It's not sustainable. It's not good for communities. It's not good for the environment, dare I mention. It's one of the things that Jordan just illustrates so brilliantly in the pyramid scheme video is that he's like, the Greens seem to think housing is something you can buy from a shop, like that if you just get, $10 billion, you can just buy a bunch of homes tomorrow and they can all just be there. And that's not how this works.
No. And, one of the other points that he makes is around renters and renting. One-third of Australians rent. It's obviously a large issue. It's a large group of people. We were renters for most of our lives. Still at this point in our lives, it's fair to say we've been renters for most of our lives. But the Greens, what the Greens wanted was unconstitutional, and that was that there be a rent freeze imposed by the Commonwealth. We've discussed that on previous episodes. What the National Cabinet has agreed to do, and this is a discussion among the First Ministers, is to develop nationally consistent policy around reasonable grounds for eviction, so you can't have the no-fault evictions, moving towards limiting rent increases to once a year. We saw when inflation was taking off, some people's rent was being increased in some jurisdictions every month or every 3 months. Some jurisdictions already have caps on how often rents can be increased. Keeping in mind, again, not every state and territory has exactly the same powers and not all of them would have the power to implement a rent freeze. Anthony Albanese made that point today. But also putting in minimum rental standards so that you can't just rent someone a moldy old shoebox and call it a home. You've got to have heating and cooling and you've got to have appropriate, space. It's got to be windows that can be closed and locked. These are some things that, a lot of people take for granted, but in some parts of the country, particularly when there's severe shortage of housing, you have unscrupulous landlords. Not every landlord is unscrupulous. I'm going to say that because it's true, but there are more unscrupulous landlords than we would like, and unscrupulous landlords who will charge a premium top dollar amount, because of a lack of supply. What this is going to do is increase supply. It's going to put in place regulations around what rental housing can look like. It's going to put in place incentives to change planning rules. Now, the Greens can either get on board or get out of the way here because the Greens are, by and large, the most organized local government political force in this country. They are. By far and away, you see Greens councillors in inner city councils right around the country. They are organised at that level. They get mobilised at that level. And planning is one of those things where they are most active and most vocal. So there's a real disconnect between the rhetoric of Max Chandler-Mather and the reality on the ground when it comes to Greens and planning. Now, states now have an incentive to put in place new rules and new laws and enforce those. Local governments have the incentives now to do the right thing. Even if there is a small group of NIMBYs, they're not in my backyard people, who don't want medium density housing around train stations, there should be. Of course there should be. Essential workers shouldn't have to travel 3 hours each way to get to their nursing job or their teaching job or their cleaning job.
I have literally no idea why we haven't realised the potential of housing on top of train stations. That, I mean, in Europe it's just such a no-brainer. Like, yeah, you know, it's really, it's confounding the idea that you wouldn't realise that, hey, man, this is where the train is. Good, this is where we should put the people.
And that's what the National Cabinet discussions today have said, well-located housing, and there's incentives to make that a reality and to help make that a reality. But, you know, this is, we've talked a lot about the economy over the course of our nearly 1 million downloads.
We're getting so close.
It'll happen with this episode. This episode will be the episode.
Stay with us, friends. Stay with us.
1 million downloads. About wages, and we've talked about all of the economic conditions that working people have had to endure over the last decade of Morrisonism. Well, we've had a year of Albanese and Jim Chalmers running the economy, and it has shifted things. For the first time in years, we've had a wage outcome over the last quarter that has kept pace with inflation. That means that for the first time in years, we're talking 5 or 6 years, on average, workers have not gone backwards in real terms. Now, you know, it seems weird for us as trade unionists to be celebrating that outcome. We're not celebrating it as much as some people are. I appreciate there are some people who are celebrating that a lot. But it is a milestone, because instead of going backwards in the last quarter, the average working person has kept pace. Now, of course, we want to see that. We want to see working people get there more, because quite frankly, corporations, corporate executives have been profiteering. Alan Kohler did some brilliant work on this on the ABC with his finance report recently, and he's put it out on social media. You can check it out. That the profiteering, the price gouging that's happened, shout out there to the ACTU for their price gouging inquiry. You can check that out with Alan Fells. There's links all over the place. But that has undermined the living standards of average working people in this country, at the same time as the rhetoric from the high priests at the RBA and people like Scott Morrison has been that, oh, wage breakouts would destroy the economy and that's what's the big risk and so on and so forth. The reality is, now that working people's wages are keeping up with inflation, inflation is coming down. It's coming down. You know, this is the reality in which we live in. We're not talking about ideology here. This is not my theory. This is not Marx's theory. This is nobody's theory. These are observable realities in our economy. So we need to accept that there are some things that we can intervene in, we can make improvements to. It's not all going to happen at once. A bit like what Geordie says about housing. You know, interventionist economic policy will change things. It will move things, but it won't happen immediately. Even the grand wizard of the RBA, who's now on his way out, Phil Lowe, admitted that it takes 12 to 18 months for each rate rise in monetary policy, each interest rate rise, to have its effect on the economy. So even that mechanism is, it takes time. We've had 12 to 18 months of Labor in government. The first day was not the first day they passed policy, passed new laws, had economic interventions. But we're starting to see 12, 18 months down the track that some of their interventions are having the desired effect. We are starting to see workers' wages keep pace. We're starting to see inflation come down. We're starting to see policies being made that will increase housing supply. That will again put downward pressure on the cost of housing for working people. So I know people get frustrated, and we all want it now, and we all want our wages to be better today and tomorrow. We wanted them better yesterday. But the struggle continues. It never ends. And the changes will take time, but we shouldn't just embrace some nonsense, half-baked feel-good sugar hit idea that somebody comes up with on a whiteboard, just as we shouldn't embrace the naysayers who say it's not possible because you've got to support the invisible hand of the market and you've got to get out of the way and the government's the problem. Either end of that spectrum is the wrong place to be. Where we are is actually having results, and in the medium and long term, we'll have very good results if we stick with it. That's my analysis of the economic time in which we find ourselves, Van.
Right. Speaking of time, it's time for some good news, Ben. And I'm going to totally own this good news because it's about my hometown. It's about the beautiful industrial city of Wollongong, where I spent the formative years of my youth.
Windy, windy Wollongong.
And it's windy, windy now. It is windy, windy Wollongong, because Chris Bowen has gone to Wollongong as the Minister for Climate Action, and he has delivered some and how. So those of you who may be unfamiliar with the most beautiful city on earth, Wollongong, it is on a coal seam, and its dominant industry for a very long time was coal mining. And also copper smelting all kinds and coke ovens and all kinds of really heavy industry. The kind of industry that is possibly associated with terrible health outcomes in that town. And for years, Wollongong had two problems, either really high unemployment, when I was there, youth unemployment was 20%, or terrible effects from heavy industry and pollution.
But there's good news, Van.
The good news, getting to that, Ben, I'm just so excited, is that what the government have announced is a massive investment in offshore wind in the Illawarra area. So Illawarra is the name of the region that Wollongong is in. And 60 kilometres of coastline in the roughly from Wombarra to Kiama has been zoned to have offshore wind. And it's going to create thousands of jobs. And for the first time, no one's going to have to protest going, but children's eyes are bleeding. And I went to those protests in the 1990s around the copper smelter, where people's eyes had historically bled from copper in the air and those kind of things, because we were desperate for jobs. And I remember that was it's 300 jobs and it's worth it in this town, which is structurally organized around heavy industry. And it's enough power will be generated from this offshore wind infrastructure, 4.2 gigawatts, which is enough to power 3.4 million homes. Like, I can't even tell you how transformative that is for that community, recognizing its industrial past, going, actually, this is a place that has a necessity because of the steelworks, everything else, that has the necessity of high energy production, that has the people, that has the skill environment for this kind of, like, it's just absolutely incredible. I got really emotional when I heard about it. That's exactly what we should be doing. When we talk about a just transition, and they will be good union jobs as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's nearly 1,500 square kilometres in size, this area. It is off the shore, so there's been some consideration given to the environmental impacts for some sea life, and birds and various animals. I mean, it's a consultation process at the moment, but it's phenomenal.
When I lived in Wollongong, we didn't even have birds, Ben. It was kind of a quiet place because of the smelting.
Yeah, well, the Illawarra Renewable Energy Zone from the New South Wales government is there as well. It's a phenomenal outcome, Van. Speaking of phenomenal outcomes, we will crack over 1 million downloads for the week on Wednesday. This is our 146th official episode. Of course, we've done specials. We do the weekend wrap. We've started the Van Batterman Conversation With series. We've done fringe festivals. We are an award-winning podcast. We've done election night broadcasts. So many different things that so many people have liked, have shared, have commented on, have sent us feedback about. You know, if we haven't got back to you on some of your feedback yet, we will. It's just been an absolutely busy time, but of course it's been possible because some people, not only is this podcast free to download and listen to, but we do advertise this podcast to build the audience, to get the message to more people. And there are some people who do make a financial contribution. They make one-off contributions, buck a week contributions, $10 a week to be our Extend the Reach contributors, or $20 a week to be our cadre. And they go to www.buymeacoffee.com patreon.com/weekonwednesday. And Van, you give a shout out to our cadre and our Extend the Reach every episode.
I do.
And they are.
Our cadre are Mega Ichisaurus, Matt Trezee, Shamila Lakal, Ms. Deanne Weir, Joe Lockery, Steph, Karina Barley, Jane C. Campbell, Yona Gibbons, Anne Coleman, Ross Kenner 888, Bronwyn Cockington, Terry Butler, Jack Powell, Gail Ferguson, Rebecca Fanning for Longman, Matthew Hadley, Colin Kelly, Ali Vance, Mary M, Love Your Work, Yeet Yeti, Andy Balden, Claire, Jason Dallas, Camille, Akiva Boris, Gabe Kramer, Stephen Aitken, Trish Corey, Greg Miller, Kathy Birch, Fiona McNeil, at Jay Carney, Christine Cole, Bronwyn, Punch Drunk Veteran, Journey Forster 7, Andrew Pascoe, Cassandra Tui, Ian Hampson, No Twitter for Me, Hannah A. Honda, Matt Bush, Richard Sands, Glenn Robbie, Brash Daniels, Kylie Phillips, Linda Cartwright, Leanne Shingles, I don't have Twitter, my name is Susan Myers, Kerry Nash 20, Billy Three McCabe, Nerissa Simon, at Katagal, Lauren Ash and Banjo, at Narunga Man, John Sharp and Peter Barth, Louise Watson, also known as Red, White and Blue Lou. And our Extend the Reach supporters are Murray Bardwell, Stuart Munn, Blagoy, Matthew Case, Marky Mark at Big M Bid, Adrian Valente, Mizritza at Caradale 68, Frank Nahouse, Erica Pizzuti, Joe Lupino, Rachel Fitzpatrick, Kerry Arthur, Pauline Bay, Shane Horsfall, Helen Murray, Buzzard 62, Janet McCalman, Jeremy Moe, Rosie Elliott, Lara, at Robert Knopfield 1, Michael Whale, Sanj Kelly, Dorina, Donald Vaughan, Damien Marley, Michelle Norton, Rodney Slap, Cameron Tri Dragon, Daniel at Crazy Keza, John DeHaan, Ange Fennell, Anna Uren, Melanie Denning, Jody A, Penelope Judge, Jane Holloway, Spirit of Anger and Hope, S. Wood, at Didham, Sharon Kelly, Beck and Lola, Richard Grever, someone, Vita W, Nadita Hannah, Maura Louise Hawker, Megan Wickett, Graham Oxley, Tracy Lucas, Sandy Honan, at Galvest, Greg Martin, Trainer, Amy Fawcett, not on Twitter, Sarah Elian and Andrew, Ivor Spillett, Andrew Bryan, Peter O.C., Linda Sam Hadid, Kip Addison, Lizette Twizzle, Bunker Basher, Katie Ward, at The Real Never Longbody, and Sandy Baumgart, at North Sandy B, at Renee McGee. Oh, man, so it's just suddenly gotten dark here, so I did that in the dark.
Well done. Congratulations, and congratulations to all of our supporters for helping make this a top 15 political podcast on Apple Podcasts this week. We are regularly in the top 20. It just wouldn't be possible. Van, such love for all of our supporters.
Oh, we love them. We love you all. And we love it when we do events and you come up and say, hi, we're one of your supporters. And we get really excited.
And of course, join me on Sunday for the weekend wrap, where I will be looking at some of the things that have happened at ALP National Conference up in Brisbane over the weekend. Won't that be intriguing for people? But until then, love you, Vanny.
Love you too. Bye.